The Hallie Kasser Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, and is always available for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. Thank you so much for being here. I am Hallie Kasser Jane. Today on the Hallie Kasser Jane Show, joining me at my table is Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer David Hume Kennerly. From Vietnam to the Ford White House to the set of The Last Days of Seinfeld, Kennerly's images have been startling eyes for nearly half a century. We'll talk about his amazing career as well as his new book, David Hume Kennerly on the iPhone. But before we begin, a brief message from our sponsors. You are listening to The Hallie Kasser Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds. The Hallie Kasser Jane Show is always available online at HallieKasserJane.com and a host of venues, including Blog Talk Radio. And be sure to visit us at our newest home on iHeartRadio. Today, The Hallie Kasser Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles in virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at audibletrial.com/The Hallie Kasser Jane Show. David Hume Kennerly. Not a name you recognize? Let me help you out. He's the man behind the camera who won the 1972 Pulitzer Prize for his iconic images of the Vietnam War and the Allie Fraser fight. He was a mere 25-year-old UPI photographer at the time, one of the youngest people to ever receive that honor. 2 years later, Kennerly was appointed President Gerald R. Ford's personal White House photographer and has been recording American presidents' images ever since. Named one of the most 100 most important people in photography by American Photo magazine, Kennerly was a contributing editor for Newsweek and a contributing photographer for Time and Life magazines. He has published several books of his work, among them Shooter, Photo Op, Sign Off, The Final Days of Seinfeld, Photo du Jour, and Extraordinary Circumstances, The Presidency of Gerald R. Ford. He's a producer and one of the principal photographers of Barack Obama, the official inaugural book. Recently, he contributed his talents to The President's Gatekeepers, a 4-hour documentary about White House chiefs of staff that ran on the Discovery Channel. The man with the golden eyes, Kennerly serves on the board of trustees of the Gerald R. Ford Foundation. His archive is housed at the Center for American History at the University of Texas, Austin. For many, that would be enough, but not for David Hume Kennerly. Out with a new book, David Hume Kennerly on the iPhone, a collection of images taken with, yes, an iPhone, with images you won't soon forget. Let's talk. So, David, you have got to pinch yourself every day when you wake up. I mean, how did this happen? How did a kid from Roseburg, Oregon, wind up photographing every American president since Richard Nixon? I mean, this is your story, you know? It's pretty extraordinary. You win the Pulitzer for feature photography and actually named official White House photographer for President Ford, and that's just the beginning. I mean, talk to me. How did this happen?
Well, actually, all that was before 30.
So it's all over at 30 anyway. That's what they tell us.
When I hit 30, I figured, okay, I'm washed up. All the good stuff has happened now. We're done. But, you know, my first book was called Shooter, and it came out in 1980, officially classified as a rare book now, which is, I guess if you've lived long enough to have a rare book, you've really done something. But the story was about, which I wrote about my experiences up to that point, were an American success story. I mean, where else in the world can you come from a little town, a little lumber town in Oregon with no political connections and end up working in the White House, total access to the President of the United States? I mean, you know, I'm a very patriotic guy to that degree that I don't know anywhere else on the planet that's like our country where those kind of things happen.
You know, it appears to me that it happened because you have multiple talents. I mean, certainly you have the artistic eye, and we'll talk about that. But you also appear to have courage and drive. Oh, my God, do you have drive? And a knack for getting yourself to the right place at the right time. So where did all this drive come from? Because you have drive.
Well, I think the courage part sometimes could be you could substitute really stupid. But, you know, to me, it's a fine line between those two
items. Relate.
But my dad was a traveling salesman, and I used to go around with him. And basically, I learned from him how you sell people things they don't really want. So, and that applies very well to my career, because there are so many times where you are trying to get inside to photograph a political figure or a movie star or somebody, and they don't really want to do it. But if you could convince them that this is a good idea, then they'll go for it. And so I learned that from my dad. You know, being a photographer, there are a lot of good photographers around. It's not everything. You've got to get in, get the pictures, get them out. Certainly in the days before digital, where you had to ship film or get somebody to carry it for you. You have to be a producer. There are so many elements that go into making this career. It's not just one thing. I know a lot of really great photographers, and in the news business, I would be able to compete with any of them, no problem.
But you do have the eye. Were you born with it? Did you develop it over time? Do you see dead people? What's the deal with that eye of yours?
Dead. I was like, no. I don't, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with, there's some soulful elements that I don't know. I think if in my case, you're really lucky to discover something that you do well. I don't know whether I learned it. I definitely didn't learn it in school because I picked up everything on my own. I never took a class in photography except a senior in high school where I was helping to teach the class, really. But I think you do have certain abilities. I think the trick is figuring out what they are, and I did. And even the new book about David Hume Kennerly on the iPhone, I talk about, I can show you where to look, but I can't teach how to see. I don't think anybody can be taught how to see, but I do believe you can be pointed in the right direction. And that's what I like doing with younger photographers or anybody who wants to take better pictures.
It is a great book, and we're certainly going to spend a lot of time on it. I think to understand what you say in the book, people need to understand you. You fascinate
good,
me.
Good luck on that.
Well, maybe not you, Ken, but I will.
I've had that question.
You picked up that first camera when you were a little kid. It was in a Brownie Hawkeye. I love that. I had one of those. Do you remember why you started shooting pictures? What were you looking for? Maybe you were hoping to define something. That seed of your interest in photography, is it wanting to understand people and events and things, and photography offered that opportunity? Did you ever really sit down and try and figure that out?
I have never analyzed myself to that degree, although as I got older, I had a much better idea of why I was doing it. I'll tell you one story when I was a kid. And I know this is impactful to me because I remembered it when I wrote Shooter. I had to ask questions of myself, like, why am I doing what I'm doing? Where did I start? Everybody wants to know where it started. And there was a fire down the street from my house. Some guy's garage had burned up. And, you know, in Roseburg, Oregon, that was a big news story. And they had a little newspaper there with one photographer, I think. And I ran down must have been 11, 12 years old, maybe. And the firemen are there. They're putting out the fire. And then this guy with a camera is able to go across the police line and take pictures. And I thought, my God, that's something that I really would like to do because I like adventure. I like the idea of adventure anyway, and getting close to the action. And so that really had a lot to do with it, whether it was because I want to show what's going on or do I just want to see the flames up close. I don't remember at that point, but I do remember seeing that guy. That's a memory that stuck with me. And then my first published photo was in 1962 in the Roseburg, Oregon high school newspaper. And when I saw it in print, and it was not a particularly good photo, I think it was a football game. Oh no, it was a guy crossing home plate. It was a crummy photo, but it was in print. And I thought, that is so cool. Something I took a picture of has been published. And that had a big effect on me. It really did.
I don't mean this in a derogatory way because I've experienced myself being a journalist during part of my life and taking photographs. There's a certain power to it as well, isn't there? I mean, you know, when I have that camera and I would run up into places that nobody else could get, I knew where I was, what I was doing. I could control some of a situation in a way. Did that ever cross your mind? Or am I just a power freak?
You know, there's so many elements. That's one. I mean, I can see that. That's one element. When I got into high school, and I really, at that point, was pretty set on a career in photography, I realized that by working for the school paper and the annual, I could get out of class to go take photos. In 1964, I was a junior in high school. At this point, I'd moved up to West Lynn, Oregon, outside of Portland. And Don Scholander was coming back from the 64 Olympics, and he lived in the next town over. And I think he'd won several several gold medals. I can't remember how many, but I was able to go out there, take a picture of this guy who was very well known in the community, and that was exciting to me. But at 64, I really knew I wanted to be a professional photographer and a newspaper photographer. That was the important thing.
So this power thing, though, you know, is there a certain power to having the control of that camera and moving into spaces?
I think having power is the image that you produce, ultimately. How many people see that image? For me, it's never been a power trip per se, but I really do think it's been important, not only my pictures, but anybody who takes photographs that make a difference in your life. There's a certain power to that, and it's a good power. It's really showing what other people do to each other in the world. But I never viewed it as my own personal power trip. I just think it's been more of a magic carpet ride for me that camera has taken me all over the world to, you know, dozens of countries and to see things that most people don't want to see or that some people would love to experience.
And to the seat of power. We were talking about power. You know the phrase capture an image? Is that what you do? Is that a phrase you can relate to, or is it something different or more than capturing? What is it?
You know, I see on that when I'm looking on my Facebook page and somebody says a great capture, I'm kind of uncomfortable with that characterization. I don't know why. I mean, it's like being called a photojournalist. You know, it's so common that term is being used now, but I don't like that. I'm a photographer. I'm happy with that. But we say take a picture. I guess it's the same thing. You take a picture. The old photographers used to say they made a good picture. I kind of like that. I mean, you definitely had something to do with getting that photo.
So let's go back a little bit. You joined the National Guard, right?
I joined the National Guard in 1966. From my age point, I'm 67 years old, born in 47, early baby boomer. 1965, the year I graduated from high school, we were looking down the barrel of that Vietnam gun. It was really just starting to churn. A lot of troops are being sent over. The Marines landed in Da Nang. And I did not like the vision of me charging the hill led by some young kid from Kentucky who was like 3 years older than I and really wanted to take that hill. You know, that was not something I was comfortable with. And so I managed to get into the National Guard and did my 6 months active duty. I went to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. I went to Fort Benjamin Harrison, Indianapolis, and then went back to do my monthly service. In those days, if you got in the National Guard, your chances of going to war were very remote. Unlike today, if you go in the National Guard, I know National Guard's people have done two or three tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it was a little different atmosphere back then.
And oddly, you wind up in Vietnam anyway, but we'll talk about that in a minute. I first want to go to your early career.
By this point, I'm in Portland, Oregon. I went to Portland State College for about a half hour, and I got a job on the Oregon Journal. And so I was, I may have just turned 19. I was either late 18 or early 19, as a staff photographer. I was replacing another guy who'd actually gone off, ironically, to do 6 months active duty. So I was shooting pictures full-time staff photographer when I was just a kid. And
amazing. So,
but the ultimate irony for me was that I had to get out of the National Guard to go to Vietnam. I didn't have a political issue with Vietnam, but then I saw it as this huge story, and I was going to miss the story. And I think for somebody of my generation who was in the news business to not go to Vietnam, it would have plagued me for the rest of my life. I won't speak for anybody else.
So was it curiosity that got you there as much as anything?
No, well, it was curiosity. Listen, I had, at that point, four schoolmates from Westland High School had been killed in Vietnam.
God.
And I felt bad about that, certainly. But by this point now, I'm in Washington, D.C. And I mean, I had my first ride on Air Force One when I was 23 years old as a UPI photographer.
Oh,
and so
Lord.
A lot of guys would try to go to the war to come back and get a job like that. You know, I already had a job like that. And I did not want to be sitting here talking to you now, however many years later, and been asked the question, why didn't you go to Vietnam? That's a question I could not have lived with myself. And so I pulled every string I could to get a leave of absence from the National Guard. And I was very lucky that I had a commanding officer general who was a reserve officer. And he was a lawyer, pretty well-known lawyer in Washington, D.C. And I went to him and said, look, General, I've got this opportunity for UPI to go to Vietnam. And he kind of said, well, why would you want to do that? You know, why are you here? You know, like in this unit. But I said, I really would like to go. Is there anything you can do to help me out? He said, let me get back to you next week. He called me up a week later, and he literally went over and talked to the Army Chief of Staff, who's the head of the U.S. Army on the military side, four-star general, and brought up somebody he knew, and he brought this up, and the guy said, well, we could probably arrange it. He said, I don't think we'll be creating an ugly precedent here. So the guys were not going out of the National Guard to Vietnam, because they wanted to. Trust me on that. And I got out. I got a leave, and I went to Vietnam. A lot of people, photographers, were getting killed. The week I was getting ready to leave to go to Vietnam, and I'll never forget this. I mean, there was a helicopter that was shot down over Laos, and it was very early 1971, which is when I was heading over. It was already arranged. I was going to go over, and I was going to replace Kent Potter, who was one of the UPI photographers, and Kent and Larry Burroughs and a Japanese photographer working for Newsweek and Henri Hewitt working for AP got shot down and they died. And literally the week I was leaving for Vietnam, and Larry Burroughs, I'd never met, but Larry Burroughs was a personal hero to me. Larry Burroughs had a, in fact, anybody who's listening to this wants to see a great story, look at, it's called The Flight of Yankee Papa 13. You'll find it online under Life Magazine Stories. Yankee Papa 13 was a helicopter designation call sign, and Burroughs went with that crew and photographed the crew. The first image in the story was this young crew chief with a machine gun, and he's smiling, walking over to get on the helicopter. And then Burroughs is in the helicopter, even mounted cameras on the machine guns outside. But the guy was a phenomenal photographer, and the helicopter is taking a bunch of Vietnamese troops into the action, and one of the other helicopters, a Marine chopper, got shot down. So they landed near it, and they went over and to try to rescue these guys and brought them into the chopper. There's a photo then of Farley, which is the cover of the magazine, yelling, and there's a body of one of those guys laying there. And it just was an incredible picture. But the one that what cinched it for me and really provided the direction of my life where I wanted to go as a photographer, there was the last picture in the story was Farley alone back at the base in a warehouse, like on some ammo boxes, and he had his head down and he was crying. Mm. And it was like a beginning, a middle, and the end. It was like a Shakespearean drama come to life from Vietnam. And that had such a profound impact on me. And so Burroughs, my hero, was on that helicopter along with the guy I was going to replace. And I got to tell you, I was scared to death then. I mean, all of a sudden it became real. You know, these are people, and I didn't know any of them, but I knew of them, certainly, and they all had an impact on me one way or another. And I could have, at that point, kind of jumped off the train, but I was determined to go, and I did.
And for your extraordinary work, win the Pulitzer Prize, 25 years old?
Backing up just a tad, my last assignment in the United States,
right,
March 8th, 1971, I really remember the date because I was 23 years old. The next day I was going to be 24 on my birthday, and I covered the Ali Frazier fight in Madison Square Garden. It was the first time they fought, both undefeated champions. I had a ringside seat to shoot the fight, and it was kind of a going away present by UPI to me. And the photos I took, one appeared on the front page of the New York Times of Ali getting knocked down in the 15th round, and then there was another one that was on the front page of the New York Times or the back page in the sports section. But anyway, I really scored on that one. Ali lost that fight, and it was my 24th birthday. That picture, also because it was published on March 9th, was the first photo in this portfolio of photos from the year of 1971, most of which was Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, that won me the Pulitzer Prize for feature photography in 1972 when I was 25.
Which is a scary thing in a way. To achieve the success at that age, wow! You know,
I know,
you have your whole life ahead of you. Are you always thinking?
I know, but you know, it's like I've known other people who won a Pulitzer and ended up just working the overnight shift because they didn't. But I was thinking, okay. I mean, I had no idea I'd been entered for it. So it was a total shock when I won. These days, you know, you have these campaigns by all these news agencies,
right,
and organizations, and, you know, really concerted effort to win Pulitzer Prizes. These photos were entered by Larry DeSantis and Bob Schnitzlein in New York, who were two editors of mine. I knew nothing about it. In fact, when I heard about it, and I was in Saigon, and I was at that point the bureau chief for UPI Photos, I thought they were joking. joking. I thought somebody was like playing a cruel joke on me there. And my answer to that, and I'll never forget it, because that's a really good question about what does that do to you? You know, yeah. I mean, you peak early. I'm 25 just. And I was in my room, and I had an apartment over the bureau in Saigon, and it had a ceiling fan, and I was laying there, and I'm like watching. It was like, oh, that scene from Apocalypse Now later in the beginning. Here's a ceiling fan, you know, the sound of the helicopters in the background. And I was wondering, what does this mean? I mean, I'm 25 years old. You know, I'm doing what I love doing, and I win a Pulitzer Prize. Well, what does that mean? That's like, it is kind of scary in a way. It's not a lifelong ambition of mine. I never thought about winning a Pulitzer. You know, I love seeing these 12-year-old kids are on some big show, and it's like their lifelong ambition is to have won that show. So what are you kidding me? You're 12 years old. You know, but it's almost kind of the same at 25. So my remedy to that was Dirk Halstead, who was my mentor at UPI, and he was now working for Time Magazine, and he came into the bureau the next day. It was congratulations, blah, blah, blah. And he said, where's the action? And so we went out of Saigon about 25 miles where the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese had this huge battle going on. And I almost got killed. And I'm laying out in the ditch as these bullets are wicking over my head and explosions, and like 25 South Vietnamese guys got killed all around us, and me and Dirk. He looks at me and he said, so man, if we get killed out here, you're the guy that everybody's going to think is really a dumb shit. You just want the Pulitzer Prize and you go out and get killed. You don't even get to enjoy it, you know? And I'm thinking, yeah, man, nobody's going to think how great it was I won a Pulitzer. They're going to think how stupid I was because I got killed the next day. Literally, that's what happened. And I was like, okay. But you know what it meant to me? That was great. What it guarantees me is a free obituary in the New York Times when I check out. But really, it was just another thing that happened, and I'm very proud of it to this day. And it's been helpful to me because people will sometimes return your phone calls where they might not have otherwise, you know. And so I've really used it in a positive way, I think.
I think you certainly have. I want to go to Robert Kennedy now, which actually you met him before you went to
Flashback.
Flashback.
1966.
You were there at the Ambassador Hotel, had just photographed him right before he was taken out by Sirhan Sirhan. What was that like?
Well, you have to go back 2 years. I've told you the Larry Burroughs story, which is profoundly important to me. And Robert Kennedy was another important character in my life. In 1966, where I just started with the Oregon Journal and graduated in the summer of 65, I got that temporary job on the Oregon Journal. And so I think it was the fall of 66, Robert Kennedy came to Portland, Oregon, and he was visiting, campaigning. It was before he was running for president. He was senator from New York, and he was campaigning for Oregon congressional candidates. And I got the assignment. It was an evening. It was the Labor Hall at Portland. And I went down there, and it was like this huge crowd. I mean, I'd never seen anything like it in Portland. And I was trying to figure out, how am I going to get through this crowd to get up to get a picture of this guy? He hadn't come in yet. And I saw two photographers on the periphery of the event, and I didn't know who they were. And so I went over and introduced myself. I said, I'm Dave Kennerly from the Oregon Journal. And one of them introduced himself as Bill Eppridge of Life Magazine. And he was traveling with Robert Kennedy, and Steve Shapiro was the other guy. And Steve, you saw his pictures from the Selma March. Steve was a great civil rights photographer. Anyway, these are two major league photographers that are traveling with Kennedy on his plane. I said, how do you guys get through this crowd? And Eppridge says, let me show you. He said, hang on to my coat. And so I grabbed it on the back of his coat, and he just sliced through the crowd. And not only that, he took me up and he put me into this place. Like, it was like kind of looking down a little angle on Robert Kennedy. He said, you'll get your best picture here because you can see him and the crowd and all that. And wow. I mean, this guy was so incredible, like this big-time photographer. And I'll never forget it. But that wasn't what rang my bell. Afterwards, there was this little motorcade that went out to the airport, and there's this DC-3 on the tarmac. The engines are running. Robert Kennedy runs up the ramp and turns around and waves. And then Bill Eppridge and Steve Shapiro, these two photographers, go up right behind him, go into the door of the plane. The door closes. The plane taxis out. I felt like Rick in the final scene of Casablanca. like a, like there goes, I want to be on that plane. And I cannot tell you what a moment that was for me. So I made up my mind right then and there. I was going to do the end of the business where I could travel like that and cover politics. Then flash forward 2 years later, I was with UPI in Los Angeles. I was over at the Ambassador Hotel. Robert Kennedy had come down from Oregon, came down to a campaign in California, and election night won California, which really meant he had a great shot at becoming the Democratic presidential nominee to run against would have been Richard Nixon. And I had the last picture of him giving the V sign. There was another UPI photographer there, and we decided he would be up on the podium and following to another rally where they went through this kitchen. They were going down to an overflow rally. Robert Kennedy was shot in the kitchen. I was not in there. When I heard what had happened, I ran outside. I had a picture of Ethel Kennedy in the back of the ambulance. It was probably one of the worst nights of my life because I had known this guy. And I actually had ended up on a plane with him on a short campaign hop between New Mexico and Arizona later. And so that was a horrible evening. It affected the whole American political landscape. And again, it was all part of my journey in life.
I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer David Hume Kennerly on the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. David is out with a remarkable new book on the iPhone, Secrets and Tips from a Pulitzer Prize-winning Photographer. We'll continue our conversation about his wonderful book, his phenomenal career, and his take on all the presidents he's photographed in his nearly 50-year career, and much more. But first, a brief message from our sponsors.
Is someone you love living with frequent pain? Are they spending more time just sitting in a chair or lying in bed or going to the ER more often? Other than taking them to the doctor, you may not know what else to do. Treasure Coast Hospice can help in more ways than you may realize. Even if you don't think your loved one is ready for hospice care, their experts can evaluate your loved one's condition and direct you to the right resources in our community. Call Treasure Coast Hospice to learn more or visit tchospice.org.
And we are back on the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. My guest today, Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer and author of the book On the iPhone, Secrets and Tips from a Pulitzer Prize-winning Photographer. Welcome back, Dave Kennerly.
Nice to have you here.
What a story, really. Remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. And so many places to go and so little time. So Watergate. Oh, my God. Vice President Agnew. You're going to change me. You're going to take me into a different time zone. I feel it coming. What?
Well, I think that I give a lot of lectures at colleges and high schools, and I have to keep reminding myself most of these kids haven't heard of Spiro Agnew or G. Gordon Liddy or Richard Nixon and President Ford. And I give a lot of these talks using subtitles usually. But that's true. When I came back from Vietnam, Watergate was going full bore. I was, at this point, I'd been hired by Oregon Journal to the Oregonian to UPI, which is United Press International. And then I was hired by Life Magazine, which folded after I'd been there less than 3 months, I think. And then I was kept on by Time Magazine and went back to the States, to Washington from Vietnam to cover politics. I was like out of the frying pan into the fire. And you couldn't have asked for better assignments than that. And so one of the assignments I got was to follow Spiro Agnew around, the vice president to Nixon, who was having some difficulty.
To say the least.
Yeah. He had to resign and fell to me to take a portrait that day that Nixon was going to announce who was replacing him. I drew the Gerald Ford straw. He was the minority leader of the House. I went up and took some photos of him, like some portraits, and he said, "You're wasting your time." And he literally had not been called by Nixon at that point to ask him if he wanted to be the replacement. That evening, it was announced that Ford was going to be the nominee to be VP, and Time kept me on and photographing him and got to know him and the family. And the night after Nixon resigned and Gerald Ford was going to be president, the night he became president, he had asked me to come over to their little house in Alexandria. And I sat around there with him and the family. It was a very small event. And after most of the people had left, he talked to me about the White House photographer's job. And here I am, a little kid from Roseburg, Oregon, sitting with the president of the United States in his living room in Alexandria. He's puffing on a pipe. And the guy who had been the White House photographer for Richard Richard Nixon had no access. He really could come in and take a couple pictures and had to leave, you know, right away. And I didn't want a job like that. I mean, I was having too good a time out there with Time Magazine. And I thought about the president's going to ask me to do this job, and I don't know if I want to do it or not. And I had a couple questions for him.
You didn't know whether you wanted to do it or not? That is hilarious.
No, I was not going to do it under those circumstances. So the president is sitting there, just the two of us in his living room, and he said, so let's talk about this White House photographer job. Are you interested? And I said, well, I would be interested under two conditions. And the first is that I report directly to you, not to the chief of staff or the press secretary. And the other is I have total access all the time to everything that's going on in the White House, all your meetings. And he looked at me, and he's puffing on his pipe, and he said, you don't want Air Force One on the weekends? And so anybody who didn't think he had a sense of humor was wrong. He also had a sense of irony. So he said, look, let me talk to Al about it. Al Haig, who was the chief of staff at the time. And it was funny, anyway, he didn't offer me the job right there on the spot. The next day, I'm over at the Time Magazine office. This is August 10th. He was sworn in at noon on the 9th, the day before. And I get a phone call. I had to be paged on the loudspeaker in the bureau and kind of a very nervous operator. And I called in. This is David Kennerly. And she said, David, President Ford wants to talk to you. And I said, oh, tell him to call back. I'm busy. And she said, he's on the phone. He didn't even have a secretary call. And so I got on with him, and he said, well, how would you like to, you know, come over or go to work? I thought our conversation was good, and I agree with what you want to do. And I said, that'd be great. And he said, well, he said, you better get over here right now. You've already wasted a half a day of the taxpayers' money.
I love
this. I'll
never
forget it. That's what he said. It was like, wow. I mean, if anybody thinks he wasn't a good Republican, they have another thing coming. But and I literally walked across Lafayette Square, which is the Time office right across from there, and into the gates of the White House, and I became the official White House photographer. I was 27 years old.
And add chutzpah to your resume.
Well, you know, I tell people that story. So how can you talk to the president like that? I said, look, if I had not, and this is a great lesson for anybody out there, when if there's something you really want in the way of a job or whatever, you better say what it is, because if it doesn't work out for you later and you never brought it up, that's your fault, not the other person's fault. And I knew him well enough that I was not intimidated by him, although the idea of sitting there talking to the president at that point, even though it's the same guy, you know, who was the day before I would be, you know, having a conversation with, but now he's the president. And it was really important to me for many, many reasons to get that right. And I really would not have done it. I did not want to do it just for the title. I wanted to do it for the job and also to do a good job for him, to document his short time in office, as it turned out. But it was a very honest look at a very honest family, and I'm really glad I did it.
We're glad you did it. You know, there are a lot of images in that period of time that we all have in our brains that are your images. There's certainly the one of Nixon departing, which you said in a recent interview I saw that you did, that was not your favorite of the photos that you did in that session, right?
Well, he was, yeah, it was on the south lawn of the White House getting on the helicopter.
Right.
Yeah, there was a sequence of photos I did of him. I was on the press stand there, but wow, what a dramatic moment that was.
I can't even imagine being there through that. And just,
I was just, you know, that was 41 years ago now.
Wow, was it that long? Time flies when you're having a good time, right?
Yeah.
But moving on from those images, I let me just say this to you. I just don't want everybody to think you're totally perfect.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that from three ex-wives, actually.
I thought I might bring that part of your life
into problem on that score. No, no, no.
No, 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 no. I mean, you were quite the man about town in those days, darling. I mean, I did some research here. I mean, first of all, you know, you've had a few wives. I've had a few husbands, I can say it.
Well, but by the way, just to back up a little bit on that. So I got married briefly when I was 21 years old.
Yeah, we all did that one.
Yeah, now... for less than a year, and it was at the time I had a nagging feeling it was not the right thing to do. I was just starting this career and all that, but I did it. We got married in Portland, moved down to LA, and then moved to New York, and at that point it was over with. And so, lest you think I'm a serial marrier, I didn't get married again until I was 37 years old.
Okay, so, okay, that makes it
that
better.
That was a fairly golden era. And then I was married for a short time. Well, a couple of years after that, and have a wonderful son by that marriage, Byron Kennerly. And my ex was on a show called 30-something.
You married everybody's heartthrob.
Mel Harris. So actually, we got married before she got that job. We got married, we met in New York at a party, and then Byron was born in Georgetown Hospital, and we got married in Lafayette Square. And I'll tell you something that nobody knows.
They know
if they were there, they know, but they nobody remembered. I'd photographed Sandra Day O'Connor for a Time magazine thing before she was selected to be a chief justice or a justice of the Supreme Court, and I asked her if she would marry us.
Really?
And she said, she said I'd love to. I got to know her really well. She's a really wonderful person. Anyway, she said, but I have this lovely friend of mine. I won't do it because if I do this, then everybody's going to ask me. And I totally got that, so. Every time I run into somebody who was at the wedding, I ask them if they remembered who married us. And we were married in Lafayette Park in front of the White House. And nobody remembers who married us. It was Kenneth Starr.
Get out of here.
Yeah, I'm serious. Kenneth Starr, who becomes Darth Vader, and he's a lovely guy. I mean, I've stayed friends with him. But so he married us.
Considered one of the most evil men on the world, according to some sources, right?
A Clinton person.
Yeah, right. Yep. Exactly. Yeah.
But
oh,
anyway,
my God.
I love Ken. He's a nice guy. And he married us. I mean, it didn't work out. That wasn't his fault. And then I was married briefly after that to another actress, Carol Houston. And now I've been married over 20 years to Rebecca, and we have two fabulous sons. And this seems to be working out. A little early to tell, but we did celebrate our 20th anniversary last year.
Well, good for you. I'm glad that you did
down
it.
Down the hill, but we're trying to make it work. And we have a 16-year-old and a 19-year-old who's a USC music student. So,
but during that period of time, you really were the bon vivant. I mean, you were dating a lot of people, amongst them, I think, Susie Jaffe, Olympic skier.
Susie Chapstick.
And Candice Bergen, darling. Did you kiss Candy Bergen?
No, we were an item.
So do you kiss and tell? Tell us, what was it like to kiss?
I cannot do that. I can't. This is, I've written three books now, although I'm seriously consider writing that book, about all my flings. My wife, we'll see how long this relationship would last.
Well, I just didn't want you to look too perfect, darling. I mean, the perfect career. You had to have some kind of fun somewhere along the line. I just wanted to make you dimensional. I mean, there was also talk about you and Susan Ford, but you deny that there was anything going on between you and Susan.
That denial goes to my grave.
Right, right.
Susan and I, by the way, we're both on the trustees on the Gerald R. Ford Foundation, so... that's kind of sounds like a grown-up job to me, which I don't like to think of myself that way.
Yeah, I hear that too.
But Susan was, I think, 18 years old when her dad went to the White House. And, that's an interesting thing. When Gerald Ford became president, he was only 60 years old. Now, when I hit 60, I was thinking, Jesus, that guy was really an old guy. I'm 27. He's older than my dad by 9 years, and I thought, 60 years old. Oh, my God. So when I hit 60, I said, wait a minute. I still have the mind of an 18-year-old. This is not like... this is 60 ain't that bad. That's not a problem. But it's kind of funny how you look at stuff, though.
I had a grandmother who was 94, and my grandfather just died. I asked her, I said, what's it feel like to be old? And she said, who feels old? I'm still 16 years old. I look in the mirror, I swear that's what I see is 16.
I believe
I relate to that.
I 16 or 18, but I feel that way.
Right. She was making the point. I mean, and I think it is true. And you can hear it in your voice. Listen,
but by the way, I'm paraphrasing Ansel Adams. Ansel was a friend of mine. I did the Time cover photo of him. He's the only photographer that's ever been on the cover. We were talking about photography, which is what my whole life has really been about. Ansel said that your photographs are the product of every person you've met, every book you've read, every piece of music you've heard, every person that you've run into, and that's true. Your photographs are the product of all of that. And I believe it. I think that my experiences in life, it's a cumulative effect. the more you see, the more you understand with any kind of luck. Although sometimes I don't believe that when I see the way people act toward each other. But it's been what's driven my career. And everything I've done has been on the people side of things. It's been being in the room watching a decision made to start a war or end a war. All these experiences I've had in photograph have been about carrying that image out where other people could see it and get a better understanding of what goes on in the world. And a lot of it's stuff you don't want to see.
My favorite, one of my favorite, because there are a bunch of my favorites of your images, but one of my favorites is the one of Betty Ford on the cabinet room table. That image breaks every concept that we have of what life is really like in the White House.
At least, yes.
Right?
At least every concept. Can you imagine? I mean, look, Mrs. Ford was a remarkable human being. She and I were such good friends. Like, people say, what are the Fords like? Questions I hate. But I said, well, President Ford, I'll tell you in a nutshell about Mrs. Ford. If I heard a really off-color joke, I would never tell it to the president. Not because he would be offended so much as he wouldn't get it. But I'd tell it to Mrs. Ford. Because she had a malicious, delicious sense of humor, you know. And Mrs. Ford was like, was such a great spirit and just mischievous. And that photograph was taken the day before they left office. It was January 19th, 1977. She was going around in the West Wing talking to people, saying goodbye. And we walked by the empty cabinet room, which you have to understand at that point, I mean, that was a male-dominated empire. I mean, very few women sat around that table in a capacity of power, very few. And she goes in there and looks around. Nobody's there. There are just some portraits on the walls of long-dead presidents. And she looked at me and she said, you know, I've always wanted to dance on the cabinet room table. And I thought, oh, my God. I could see the glint in her eye, and I knew she was going to do it. She was a former Martha Graham dancer. She was in very good shape. So she took her shoes off and hopped up there and struck a pose, which is the photo you're talking about, then hopped off and kind of brushed her hands and say, I think that'll about do it for this place. And that was her. I mean, you would never, I mean, the idea of any other first lady doing that is just beyond imagination.
Looking back, was she loaded or was she just, she had the devil in her, the adorable devil in her.
That's right. She was not, in fact, that photo wasn't printed for many years after they left office. Not too long after, she sought help at the Long Beach Naval Hospital for alcohol and drug rehabilitation. And, you know, I figured if that picture was printed at any time during that period or for quite a ways afterwards, everybody would have thought, or if it was these days, somebody would have put a martini glass in her hand or something. It wasn't like that at all. And in fact, the book came out, Photo Op, that one particular book came out in, I think, 93. And so that was at least 15 years later. And I showed her the context of the book. I wanted to use that picture. It was restricted at the Ford Library for that very reason.
Yeah.
I said, would you mind if I use this picture? And she said, she just laughed when she saw it. She'd never seen the photo. And she said, I remember that. Oh, yeah. And President Ford was there. And he said, well, Betty, you never told me you did that. And she looked at him and smiled and said, there are a lot of things I never told you, Jerry. And anyway, she said, sure, you could use it. Absolutely. And so I did. And I actually have the only signed print of that photo.
Oh,
in
existence. Wow.
And, she was great. I mean, oh, my God. And what she did for women, not only the Betty Ford Center, but if you recall, in 1974, shortly after they became the first couple, she was diagnosed with breast cancer and was advised told she didn't have to disclose the nature of why she went into the hospital and all that. She said, no, it's really important that women know what happened here. And it was she was the one that wanted to go out and talk about breast cancer. President Ford stood by her, and that was who Betty Ford was. And I think she is probably on the most extraordinary people I've ever met list. She's a top five, if not number one.
Yeah, it brings to mind a couple of things. First of all, you had the really special chance in life to breathe the rarefied air of the White House. You lived inside the bubble. Can you explain that feeling?
Well, you know, it's such a whirlwind. I don't want to give you some cliche-ridden response to that. But, you know, when it all happened, in my case, I was always, as a member of the press corps, you're out there, as you know, with your nose, you know, up against the window trying to get a glimpse of what it's really like. There's only one way you can do that, and that's to really be in there. But it was all, everything happened so fast all the time. It's such a remarkable place, and it's not a very big place. You've been there. You know, it's like the White House, the Oval Office, the West Wing. I mean, it's not a big, it's not like you saw it on the West Wing, you know, and I was so intent on doing my job. I mean, I was over there. The president would have his CIA briefing at 7 a.m., and I was always one of the first people there, one of the last people to leave with him. And I was putting in literally 12, 16-hour days every day. This is hard to imagine considering that social life we were talking about, which was a little more limited than I would have liked. But I knew it was going to be over with. That was the main thing. I knew that whether he won or not, you know, after the election of 76, that there's a finite time frame. And when you walk out of that gate, they take your pass away from it. From you, it's like you've had your epaulets taken off and your sword broken. You cannot even turn around and go back in that gate, even if they know who you are right then and there. And it was a major letdown for me after riding on Air Force One the helicopters and the heads of state and traveling all over the world and going to China and seeing, Deng Xiaoping and Peking and on and on and on. And when I left the White House, I felt like the motorcade had come to a screeching halt and I was tossed out and they took off and I was standing by the side of the road wondering what the hell happened. I mean, it is one hell of an experience.
It's a ride.
And it was phenomenal for me. And as I said earlier, I wasn't even 30 years old. I mean, I'd won a Pulitzer Prize. I've been the president's chief photographer. I went through almost 2.5 years with never stopping at a red light in a motorcade. And everything came to a halt. And thank God for John Derniak at Time Magazine. He called me up and said, I want you to come back to Time as a photographer. And he sent me off for 3 months to the Middle East to photograph leaders of the Middle East because I had good connections at that point. I'd kind of lost track of where I was in Washington, D.C., and it was a really tough transition for me. And that transition got me back down to the earth, and he is long gone, but he was one of the great picture editors of all time who understood that I needed something, and not only that, he would get something out of it himself. But that's what happened.
Extraordinarily fortunate, lucky, whatever. Life is a funny thing. It takes people to funny places. Listen, you have a wonderful book out. I have to tell you how extraordinary this book is. I wasn't expecting this when I opened it up. The photographs in this book, taken with an iPhone. Oh, my God. The book is called On the iPhone, and it's a book about learning to shoot with the iPhone. What in the your genius is extraordinary. That's all I have to say. And you prove to the world it's the eye, not the machine. It's the talent, not the machine. Did you have fun with this? You went off on a year-long journey, right?
Yes, but yeah, I had great fun with it. And I think in 2000, I did a book. It was called Photo du Jour, A Picture a Day in the Year 2000. It was the turn of the millennium. The concept was shooting pictures every day with one camera and one lens. So that was a film camera, a Mamiya camera. And so it's the same point of view for the whole thing, but it was a challenge. And you know, I did the same thing with the iPhone. I've been using the iPhone. I had one of the first ones that came out, literally the first week that they came out. And then they started making all these different apps for it, which could give you a different way of looking through that same lens. And it was fun for me. And so I just challenged myself to see what I could do in 2013. Every day I would shoot, and it's like a self-imposed assignment, really. And I wanted it started out being another photo du jour kind of project, but it really ended up being a book where I was able to talk and think about how I see things, how do I do what I do, and to pass that information along to other people, and hoping to make it a their experience taking pictures better.
All I can tell you is I cherish this book, and anybody who likes photography must go out and get it because it is that special. Each image is like nothing I've ever seen before, even from you. Fabulous.
Well, that's the, and I'm always asked how many pictures it takes to get a good one. One. It takes one. even though sometimes you got to take 500 to get there, but you know, there was I mentioned something in the book about which is called David Hume Kennerly on the iPhone. It's the whole title, but I said there were more pictures taken in the last year than in history. I don't think that's right. I think there were more pictures taken yesterday than in history.
Yeah.
The smartphones are so ubiquitous. I mean, everybody's got them. Everybody shoots with them. And I really think that I can help people take better pictures. And as I said earlier, I can't teach you how to see, but I can show you where to look or give you some idea of where to look. And one of the things, everybody says, well, all right, what's a good hint? Here's one for you. I came up, it's not in the book, but it's after the fact when I've been thinking about it some more, was the Kennerly Photo Fitness Workout. And that means you go in your neighborhood, in your house, in your backyard, somewhere where you're familiar with the territory, and you photograph, take five pictures of things that you look at every day but you don't see. And you'll be surprised how many things there are when you go out looking for photos. Keep in mind, say, why do I want to take a picture of this? Not just bang, 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 or here's my face in front of the Eiffel Tower blocking the Eiffel Tower. Whatever you're doing, think about why you're doing it and what it is you want to show to somebody else, and try not to make it what you had for lunch. It's one of my hints. But I said cut back on selfies and salt. That's one of my clues in the book. But that's why, you know, it's a very well-intentioned, good-hearted, hopefully intelligent way for you to take better pictures and to think about how to do that.
It's a treasure. Trust me, it's a treasure.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I want to go back to the presidents for a minute, because you have photographed every president since Richard Nixon.
No, Abraham Lincoln. I'm like out of one of those vampire books.
You can't be that old, because then I would be a lot older than I think that I am. But talk to me about this. I mean, you practically, as we said, lived in the White House at one point also. I mean, is there a common quality that you saw in each of these guys?
Well, I think one thing they all shared, except for Gerald Ford, was a desire to be president of the United States. And people are always saying, oh, I feel so bad for the president. I said, why? I mean, these guys walked over there, or would walk over their grandmother to get there. You know, I mean, you don't just get that job without a burning desire to be there. So that's one. And for whatever your reason is, I want to do good. You know, I don't think anybody goes to that job thinking they want to be an evil person. I think some of them are talking about leadership ability, their approachability. Like Bill Clinton can walk in a room and be best friends with everybody in the room. I've seen him do it. He's a remarkable human being. And it's funny because looking at all those people as a photographer, they all have different characteristics. There's really not one of them that would walk into a room that you wouldn't notice they were there. There's a certain magnetic charm to some of them. I think at the top of the line would be Reagan, in terms of my own experience, probably Reagan and Clinton, in terms of similarity in public presence, meaning they were really good speakers. They could get you around their point of view. I think Obama's probably number three behind them. I don't think he's that great, honestly, as a speaker. I think he sounds good, but Gerald Ford was not very good at all at it. You know, how do you get your ideas across? To be a great president, you've got to be able to, something that you really believe in, you get other people to believe in it. I think Reagan had that ability. And wow, there's so many characteristics of these guys, but resilience is one of them, that's for sure.
So we were talking off air about words, so I'm going to play a game with you now. I'm going to name the president. Can you come up with one word, just if you can, on each of them?
I try without going to jail. No. They can't send me to Vietnam, so that takes the Nixon thing out of there. Let's try it.
I want to try it. I want to see what we come up with. President Nixon. You said the name, President Nixon.
Visionary.
Hmm.
Go ahead.
President Carter.
Micromanager.
Really? Wow. President Reagan.
An orator.
President Bush the Elder.
Integrity.
President Clinton. It's funny.
charming.
Bush the Younger?
I'll give you two words. Man's man.
We'll hyphenate it.
Yes.
President Obama?
President Obama, I've got a lot of great superlatives for him.
I'll take them.
He's sensational.
Wow, perfect word. And the one I think you probably knew the best, President Ford.
A fabulous person.
Interesting. Ever intimidated by power?
I don't think so. I don't think I've had time for it. I've had to deal with people who are, if anybody would be susceptible to that, it would be someone from a little town in Oregon who came up in a sort of a lower middle class background. But I always believe that we're all pretty much the same. I mean, everybody does weird things, but what I've found in common among all the people I've photographed in my life, and this could be a cliche, I suppose, but that there's not that much difference between a soldier in a foxhole and the guy sending him there. I tend to look at people as human beings I can relate to, and I think my photography kind of hopefully comes across that way. It's one thing to photograph somebody with if you're the king and you're wearing your crown, obviously you look a little different from the soldier wearing his helmet. But underneath the hat, I think we all have a lot of similarities. And one of the unpleasant things is the fact that too many people don't believe that, and they get overcome by their religion or some other source that leads them to do things that they probably shouldn't be doing or wish that they hadn't.
This is a weird question, but I have to ask it. If, God forbid, you were to lose your eyesight and you couldn't photograph, what would you be?
I'd be a singer for the Met, probably.
Can you sing?
No, I don't. But I'd have to learn something that would, like, release my artistic inner self, you know, through another way.
David, I love you. I love you.
Well, the good news is, if that happened, which would not be a pleasant thing, and I'm very sympathetic for people who can't see, that's for sure. But every person who's lost their sight I've ever met or didn't have it to begin with has always found another way to experience life, which shows, again, it's the resilience of human beings. And I don't live in fear of that, to be honest with you.
No, I don't
live in fear
of
dying. I mean, I think I've had a great run. I have great kids.
I don't think you live in fear of anything.
I don't
except
know.
Women, maybe.
Apparently, I'm not too bothered by much of anything, but it's like, I don't know where that came from, but it's like, I think if you start out with nothing, you're not too worried about losing everything, because not a hell of a lot there.
All right, is that what it is? Listen, I love your images. I love you. I love your images. Kissinger and the Geisha, I love that one. And who would have thought, you know, Sadat at the pyramids, that's just gorgeous. And the Cambodian girl crying, Nixon playing the piano. You even did a book on Seinfeld the last shows. I mean, oh my God, love it.
By the way, enough about me. Let's talk about my books. Next year will be my 50th year as a working photographer, being paid to do it. I am probably in 2017 would be when it would come out, but I'm really thinking about what does this all mean, you know. I have a title for my new book. I will disclose it here for the first time. I'm going to call it In the Room. And In the Room means certainly behind the scenes at the White House, but In the Room also, if you looked at the world as the biggest room of them all, it's how I have maneuvered through 50 years of history and being like Zelig, except
right.
I was really there. You know? And I'm really thinking about how you just mentioned some of those photos. Like, how can I do a 50th yearbook with all the things I've done and seen and make it interesting and not just a compilation of the greatest hits? So that's what I'm wrestling with right now. And that's it's mainly moving on to the next project. My life has always been about moving down the road, and that's what I'm doing.
The reason I was bringing up all those wonderful images that I just adore, and there are thousands of them. What's the one image you still hope to capture?
Oh, my gosh. I cannot tell you. It hasn't been taken yet. I know that. I'm sure of it. I think part of why I've done so well is my enthusiasm, my curiosity. What's going on around that corner? I can't wait to get up in the morning to see what I see.
I've been speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer David Hume Kennerly, author of the truly amazing book, now out in paperback, David Hume Kennerly on the iPhone, Secrets and Tips from a Pulitzer Prize-winning Photographer by way of Gough Books, with an introduction by Ed O'Neill. Do yourselves a favor. Visit David's website at www.kennerly.com. His pictures are worth all our words. Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and a host of other venues. Google The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. Which I hope you'll visit often for the latest information on our upcoming segments. Oh, and while you're at HallieKasserJane.com, don't forget to visit my blog to read my latest musings. I'll be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Audible.com features over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's HallieKasserJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at HallieKasserJane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So, till we meet again, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. It's a wrap.